Hello and welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Deputy Personal Finance Editor Kate Bealey, and joining me in the studio today is Personal Finance writer Emma Adjaman, Winterflood Analyst Simon Elliott, and on the phone we've got Peter Walls, Manager of Unicorn Master Trust. So today we're going to be talking about private equity fund Harbourvest's bid for top 100 fund SVG Capital. We'll also be looking at the health of the biotech sector following some dramatic tweets from Hillary Clinton. And we're going to be talking about peer-to-peer loans backed by property. But first on to Harbourvest and SVG Capital. And this is the news that Harbourvest has made an unsolicited $1 billion bid for private equity investment trust SVG Capital. Now, the fund made the bid last week and it claims it has the support of over 51% of the investment trust shareholders. Now, it means that Harbourvest is offering £6.50 per share, and that's quite a bit higher than the share price before the bid, but certainly lower than it stands today. So, Peter, you have held this trust, haven't you? What have you done in response to the news?
Okay, well, I sold the shares in Unicorn Master Trust on the morning of the bid at £6.50 a share. Effectively, they had good support in terms of letters of intent, the largest one being Coller Capital, and getting them over the line to a position of more than 50% on the morning of the bid, I thought was quite important. So I took the decision to sell then.
Okay. And when did you originally buy the trust, and what price?
I've been invested in SVG Capital on a number of occasions, but most recently, I started buying again back in October 2013. I think the initial purchase price was £3.97 per share. Since then, there's been quite a number of tender offers, usually a bit closer to NAV. So I've taken advantage of those tender offers and at times reinvested the proceeds into shares in SVG at a discount. So I think, you know, my average price is about £4.30 per share.
Okay, I mean, how happy have you been with how the holdings performed, how the trust performed?
Very happy indeed. It's been a fairly good journey. The company have been, you know, quite forthright in buying back shares. So there's been an ongoing program of regular buybacks in the market and tender offers. And I think, you know, that's served to accelerate the returns to shareholders.
Okay. So Simon, what do you think? Do you think this is good value, this deal, this offer?
As Peter's already said, it represents quite a significant premium to where the share price was just prior to the bid. I mean, it's up almost a pound since then. And certainly in terms of the discount to NAV, so it had results out recently to the end of July, it represents about a 10 or 11% discount. So that's tighter than it's traded for quite some time. So on those grounds, you can say, yep, it's you know, pretty attractive bid.
Okay, and I mean, just how high a bid do you think could be justified if another offer was made?
Yeah, and that's a good point, because actually if you break down what's actually in the SVG portfolio, I mean, to start with, there's a fair amount of cash. There's probably about 30% of the NAV is represented by cash, and clearly it would be a bit odd to expect to pay a discount on cash. So when you strip that out, and when you strip out a number of the other items as well that you could almost describe as cash proxies, so in other words, investments where you know, you'd expect cash to come back within a reasonably tight time period, then we think that, yeah, and even applying 10% discount on the remaining private equity investments, I think you could probably get to about 685. So again, a premium to the bid that's on the table. That's not to say there's definitely going to be a further bid, and clearly SVG Capital told the market last week that they were talking to a number of interested parties. And it'd be interesting to see how that develops. But there's no guarantee that will eventually arise in anything.
And I think you did just mention, but the trust has traded on significant discount to NAV over the long term, hasn't it? Why do you think that is?
Oh, gosh. I mean, a couple of things. Listed private equity funds have been out of favour of investors for quite a number of years. I mean, SVG Capital itself, you go back to 2006-07, before the financial crisis, it was one of the stars of the investment trust sector, trading on a premium, had a great long-term track record. Unfortunately, that disappeared through that 2008-09 period. It had a share price fall of almost 90% in 2008. and that was as a result of a large commitment it made to Permira, which following the financial crisis it was unable to make and actually had to go down a dilutive fundraising. Since then, it's recovered very, very strongly since March 2009. But even so, I think people remember the history, in addition to which we've seen a kind of change of its spots. It's gone from being a Permira a feeder fund to a more genuine fund of private equity funds. But it's still been left with a kind of largely institutional shareholder base. It's saying it's struggled to really build its attraction amongst retail investors and wealth investors.
And Peter, what do you think about that? I mean, what do you think of the fund's portfolio and how it's kind of changed over time?
Yeah, I would agree with Simon. The great financial crisis was a big problem for this fund and many in the peer group. And it's taken a long time to rebuild confidence, I think. I don't have a problem really with the portfolio and the way it's changed or the strategy. Initially I looked at it and, you know, there was cash, there was a pledge to repay some of that cash to shareholders. There was quite a lot of investments in listed securities, such as Hugo Boss at the time. So, for me, it had attractions which weren't just about listed private equity funds.
Okay. And now, Simon, Harvest has pointed to SVG Capital's $604 million of uncalled commitments. So, as in saying, it's quite an immature portfolio, which means, you know, that it could take quite a while for investors to see returns. And so they're arguing that that means this deal is good for certainty. Would you kind of agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain truth in that. So Harbourvest have said it'll take between 10 and 12 years to see this portfolio kind of roll off or mature. And I think that's true. However, there is a range of maturities in the portfolio. So they've made 9 commitments to 8 different private equity investors. But you've got a couple of those, such as one of the Cinven funds, one of the Permira funds, already 75% invested. You've got 2 further funds already 50% invested. You've also got structured products on the balance sheet, and they are very mature as well, and they represent about 20% of the portfolio. So there's a range of different maturities, and so it would be wrong to say that the cash will take 10 to 12 years coming back. That'll probably be the final amounts, but in the interim, you'll see a lot of cash coming back in probably in the next 2 or 3 years.
So, I mean, what do you think then, Simon, that investors should do, and how likely is this to go through, or could we see another deal emerge?
So to answer the second question first, I would expect some deal to happen. I think I'd be very surprised if this all disappears. So I think really investors are left with 3 broad choices. They can either accept the 650 bid from Harbour, which is undoubtedly a good bid. They can sit on their hands in the hope that another bid arises, or maybe possibly bids. And I think if we see more than one further bid, that's when it would really start to get interesting.
And then how likely do you think that is?
It's difficult to say. I mean, there will be private equity specialists who look at secondary portfolios who will be able to price this up very accurately. They will be very familiar with the underlying portfolio. It's a very good quality portfolio, and they will be able to come to a price. I think from SVG Capital's point of view, and SVG Capital are clearly courting these people. From SVG Capital's point of view, they were interested in getting more than one because the offer on the table from Harvest is a final offer. So in other words, under the takeover code, they cannot increase that offer within a 6-month period. So in theory, someone could come out with a 655 or a 660p. But if you really want to get some price traction, you need a couple of bids on the table. So I'm sure SVG Capital will be very busy trying to attract that kind of interest.
Interesting. So Peter, in your experience as an investor in this kind of asset class, how common is a takeover bid like this? Have you seen it before?
It's not all that common. I mean, you know, there are a lot of complexities with, you know, taking on an existing portfolio. Obviously, 3i took a tilt at Elektra in 1999. They were eventually rebuffed, actually, with a full and final offer on the table, which Elektra managed to see them off on that one. And of course, we've seen a change of spots of Elektra more recently with the, backdoor takeover by Sherborne.
Interesting. And I mean, discounts across this sector have been wide for a while, haven't they? Why is that, do you think?
Well, again, you know, after effects of the great financial crisis, and perhaps a little bit of distrust about the sector. You know, there was a lot of overcommitment going into the crash, that took a lot of time to work out. So we had quite a number of rescue rights issues in the sector. We had a number of funds going into realisation mode because of their overcommitment. So Candover continues in that vein today. And I think it's taken quite a long time for trust to rebuild. Discounts quite recently actually got out, post-Brexit, they got out to 30% plus in some of these funds.
Which,
you know, it didn't reflect the currency benefit for those with overseas exposure.
So was that an opportunity for you then, a buying opportunity?
Well, I think so, yes. You know, I certainly added to a number of names in the sector at that time.
And because which other ones do you hold? I know you have Standard Life Private Equity in your top 10, don't you?
Yeah, I think round about just over a fifth of the portfolio would have been invested in listed private equity funds ahead of this bid. So, you know, I've got a bit of a cornucopia, I think, of these funds. So in addition to the Standard Life Fund, I've got Pantheon, Harbourvest, Apax, Aberdeen Private Equity, F&C, ICG, still got some Electra, and I suppose I include Better Capital in that, which is another decent purchase.
So you're obviously quite a fan of this sector generally, then?
Well, it would certainly be the case. And, you know, I'm sure we've discussed in the past how I quite like discounts to NAV. I quite like looking at areas that are perhaps out of favour with other investors. And, you know, I'm very encouraged to see some very, very solid earnings growth coming through with the underlying portfolios of many of these trusts.
Okay, now, Simon, I know that you have said in maybe a recent analyst note that maybe there's a bit of an oversupply of trusts in this sector. And tell me a bit about that. What's your view on the sector generally right now?
Our view on the sector is not terribly far removed from Peter's, to be honest. So we've been attracted to it because of the value opportunities, i.e. the large discounts that many of the names have traded on. Saying that, I think you have got to be quite discerning. There are some funds that are better than others, but I think that the bottom line is that we haven't seen sufficient demand to justify the amount of supply of paper that exists in this area. And I think intuitively it makes sense because private equity is a higher risk, lower yielding asset class in the main, and that's clearly contrary to what the market or what investors have wanted over the last few years. So we have seen a significant amount of corporate activity, not just takeover bids, but in terms of tender offers, buybacks, funds electing to go into managed wind down. And I think our expectation is we'll see more of that. I think the real challenge for the listed private equity sector is to remain relevant. And talking to another private equity manager, listed private equity manager just this week, his concern following this SVG Capital bid, and his assumption was that the company will disappear at some stage, is that the listed private equity sector just becomes irrelevant to investors. It just falls off the radar. And he's clearly, you know, thinking or talking about his own book, but we would tend to agree. We think that would be a shame because it's a good use of the investment trust sector, the ability to access a more illiquid asset class, private equity, which over the longer term should and often does lead to very good returns.
Mm, so you think the message then is to investors, you know, don't take your eye off this sector and kind of grab opportunities as they come up?
Yeah, very much so. But again, they must really look to do their homework. The variance in quality of the listed private equity funds is quite considerable. So some are frankly more attractive than others.
Now we're going to move on to looking at another pretty high-risk sector and one which is also quite good to access via the closed-end structure, and that's biotech. Now, biotech went on a tremendous rally between 2010 and 2015, but since its frothy July peak last year, things have looked a bit bleak. It's been crashing, and that's partly due to a series of tweets by Hillary Clinton about price gouging in the US. She's angry at drug companies like Valeant and Mylan, the makers of EpiPen, who've been ratcheting up the price of their drugs by hundreds of percent. And that's really been taking a toll on share prices across the board. Let's have a talk about what happened between 2010 and 2015. Simon.
So that 2010 to 2015 period was a very strong one for biotech. I mean, we do see it, and I think most people would see it as a secular growth story. There are some very good demographic trends that mean biotech companies really are producing or meeting a real need for society. At the same time, the pharmaceutical companies have almost metamorphosized into more distribution type companies. So it's the biotech companies that are really coming up with drug discovery. And we've seen some incredible breakthroughs in that period of time. In addition to which, you've seen a lot of M&A activity as well. So money has been cheap during that 2010 to 15 period. And I think as a broader point, when people do look for growth amongst equities, there have been two areas that have really kind of stood out, and that's been in the IT sector, and obviously they've done very well during that time, but also biotech as well. So companies that can really demonstrate some very impressive top-line growth.
Okay, and Peter, when did you buy into biotech and why? Was it in those years or before?
I have to confess, it's probably through lack of understanding and not doing enough work that I miss out on quite a bit of the growth in the sector in that early period. So I suppose I could say I was lucky enough not to be in the biotech sector during the fallout of the last year or so. I did re-enter the sector quite recently, following effectively a 35% fall in the Nasdaq Biotech Index. So back in May this year, I bought the Biotech Growth Trust for my portfolio.
And why did you choose that one over the other options?
Well, it comes from a very good investment house with great experience and world-leading expertise. I can't profess to really have a firm grip on the outlook, but what attracted me, apart from the fact that we'd seen a serious pullback in biotech companies, was that large cap buyouts were on an average multiple of about 13 times against the S&P 500 at 17, and clearly. To be ongoing significant M&A activity in the sector. We're continuing to see a very high level of drug approvals and very, very strong sales growth. And I think, Hillary's gouging comments were perhaps a bit of a sideshow. They're relating to areas that really aren't that relevant to the biotech specialists in the investment company sector.
Yeah, because there has been a distinction. In fact, she has been drawing distinctions recently, hasn't she, between the kind of companies that she was particularly talking about. So Valeant, Mylan with EpiPens, for example, these older kind of generics companies and new innovative ones, I guess, coming up with genuinely exciting new drugs. I mean, Simon, what do you think? Do you think her tweet was, the real trigger for the sell-off? What other things involved?
Undoubtedly, the tweet did have an impact on share prices and sentiment towards the sector. But to be fair, it had had such a strong run. You could almost expect some kind of pullback at some stage.
I mean, so it was up 400% or so, wasn't it?
It'd been a tremendous performer. So, did it hit the share prices? Yes, it did. But I think there was a feeling that it might be a good time to take some profits, some money off the table.
Mm. And so what do you think of the closed-end options in this space?
So the two really leading funds are Biotech Growth Trust, as we've already mentioned, and Winterflood are the broker to that one, it's worth saying, and International Biotech. And, take a step back, I think the asset class is very interesting. Clearly, it is a higher risk, higher potential return asset class. And I think the idea of paying an active manager to invest on your behalf into a portfolio of biotech stocks for both those funds we mentioned, I think absolutely makes sense. A big debate across the wider sector about passive versus active investment. Why should you pay an active manager fees? Well, for us, I think it's a no-brainer as far as biotech are concerned, because clearly it's a highly specialised area of the market. And if you look at an operator such as OrbiMed, responsible for biotech growth, they've got 90 professionals looking at this sector. This is all they do. Just look at healthcare and the number of doctorates and specialists that they have on their books. Really does give them to a great insight, in our opinion, into what's going on in that area.
And a lot of the fund managers work in this space that do come from medical backgrounds, don't they? And or chemical backgrounds or whatever.
They're very bright people.
Yeah,
very bright people.
I mean, as an investor investing in biotech, what are you getting access to? Are you betting here on the binary outcome of drugs? Are you getting some companies with stable revenue? I think people often think biotech and they think, you know, a company living or dying on its kind of one hope. Is that an inaccurate perception?
It's a good question. I mean, I think biotechnology is a bit of a broad church now, to be honest. I think things moved on. So if you look at some of the larger biotech companies, the difference between them and the pharmaceutical companies, both in terms of size and reach and profitability, it's actually not that great. At the lower end of the sector, clearly there are some very kind of blue sky companies who have never had any revenue, never mind having any profit. So they might make tremendous returns, but clearly very, very risky and very dependent on drug approval, drug discovery and all the rest of it. So it does vary quite a lot across the piece. And it's interesting, for instance, we made on Biotech Growth. They've moved towards those larger biotech companies now, really echoing the comments that Peter made earlier, that's where they see the value in the biotech sector at the moment.
Interesting. And they have just said, or International Biotechnology has just said it will be introducing dividends, hasn't it? What level?
That's right. So they made an announcement relatively recently. They said they would look to return 4% of their net assets every year through a dividend. And that follows on the heels of a number of other investment trusts. So we had JP Morgan Global Growth and Income, which Winterflood are broker to. And we also had a number of others, I think World Trust Fund, and FNC Private Equity do a similar thing, where they also look to effectively manufacture dividends, convert capital into income. It's not uncontroversial in the investment trust world. Some people don't like the idea at all. However, I think the idea is that you're really trying to attract different types of investor onto your shareholder base. Those people that really do need yield, but actually would be quite interested in the return profile of something like biotech.
Interesting. So, if controversial area, Peter, what do you think about that?
I think there's some question over tax in terms of differing tax rates for income and capital gains. But if you're holding within a tax wrapper, an ISA or a SIP or similar pension product, then I don't have a problem with it. It's tax neutral from that point of view.
Does it change kind of whether you would invest or not?
Not me personally, for the fund. Clearly I'm looking for capital growth. That's part of my objective. But I could imagine that some people may look more favourably upon it, particularly as the discount does look quite attractive. My sort of feelings about the wider sector, private equity, the investment trust structure is ideal for this sort of long-term investment. And, the OrbiMed chaps, they are, as Simon said, very, very experienced. I wouldn't, be able to tell you how one would go about thinking about the future for a company like Gilead, which I think trades on 7.5x multiple. We've got to leave these things to the professionals. And what I would say is that the portfolio approach is very appropriate here, because you've got volatility in the index itself, but individual stock volatility is quite incredible. So Medivation was taken out by Pfizer. Basically, if you look at Medivation's price back in February this year, the takeout price was 3x that level. So it's huge volatility, and this is one area where you've definitely got to leave it to the experts.
If you didn't hold any already, would you be buying in now?
I think I would, and I think, like all of these sort of higher risk, higher return areas, you have a modest exposure to the sector.
Okay, interesting. And I should flag that we've actually got a special podcast about biotech live on the website now, which you can download from all the usual places. So finally, we're going to move on to talk about something very different, and that is P2P loans, peer-to-peer loans related to property. So if you're seeking high investment returns, this is one place to look, although it does come with much higher risk. Now, Emma's been having a look at peer-to-peer loans focused on or backed by property. So Emma, how do these P2P loans differ from others?
Well, as you say, Kate, the main way they do is their focus on the property market. So peer-to-peer lending traditionally has been a sort of an alternative to banks, where providers would bring lenders and borrowers directly, often on their websites. And most of these loans would be to individuals or to a variety of businesses. But with these new kind of providers, they're just focused on property. So looking at property companies or sole traders, and the loans they offer are secured against property. And these could be for things such as property development, either in the residential or commercial property space.
Okay, so what's the appeal of this kind?
Well, it's mostly to do with much higher interest rates that are available. I mean, the providers we looked at were starting from 4% up. And considering, you know, the low rate world that we're living in, this could be definitely attractive for income seekers. But there's also the perceived safety of a loan being secured by property, which means that if the borrower defaults, providers are able to step in and sell the property that the loan was secured against to recoup some of the lender's money.
Okay, so just how kind of risky would you say this was?
Well, you know, this is the thing, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So with the higher interest rates come much, you know, sort of higher risk profile. And there are a number of risks for investors to consider. I mean, the main one, borrower default, which is applicable to all sort of lending activities. But in this area, there's the idea that actually the property could cushion lenders from borrowers defaulting. But, you know, you need to be aware that, you know, if there was a downturn and the increase of borrowers default, that could affect the interest rate that lenders would get back. And the fact that property is an illiquid asset would also mean that there could be issues to do with, you know, the amount of the value that providers are able to recoup on selling the property, you know, if they could actually get less back from what they paid for it. And that meant would also hit returns. Issue with lender liquidity, you know, these providers are promising that lenders will be able to sell on their loans, but perhaps that's going to not be the case, again, if there was a shock to the property market or a significant downturn. And there's also particular issues related to this area. So peer-to-peer lending, still very new, you know, business and investment proposition. And many of these companies that focus specifically on property have only really been around for the last 2-3 years. So that's a very short track record and, you know, haven't really been tested. So we don't quite know how they're going to behave if there was to be a downturn. The other thing to consider is the fact that peer-to-peer lending is not protected by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. So that means that if your provider were to fail, you wouldn't receive the same level of protection that you would do if you were, say, investing in a fund where you'd receive investment protection of up to £50,000. So this is an area that's not protected by the FSCS. But providers say that, you know, they do segregate clients' money from the company money. And so, you know, in theory, even if they were to go bust, your money would still be protected. But because there isn't this additional protection of the FSCS, it's definitely something to be more cautious about and, you know, to consider how much, you know, perhaps put a much smaller amount of money that you would do in an area that is protected.
Wow, so quite a lot of risks to consider there then. And yeah, there's more analysis of that in this week's magazine, as more analysis of private equity, biotech and everything that we've discussed today. That's all we've got time for this week. So it just remains for me to thank Emma, Simon and Peter and wish you a good weekend.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.